Our next case for argument is 21-2324, Hyatt versus PTO. All right, Mr. Grossman, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Andrew Grossman for the appellant, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. When Congress changed the patent term regime, it provided relief to applicants with long-pending applications who stood to lose years of patent term if they had to file continuing applications subject to the new regime.
I have a question. How in the world is this an amendment to a claim? You've got 7 whole new claims that, apart from the word a or comprising, bear no resemblance to the originally filed claims.
Your Honor, that's the PTO's position, but I think if you actually look at the claim comparison that was prepared by the PTO examiner in this case, you'll see that the subject matter actually does bear a relation.
What page do you want me to look at?
Sure, Your Honor. Page 9599 of the appendix. There's a claim comparison table. I'd be happy to talk about it. I think the one that makes this clearest is claim number 146. If you look at claim 46 in the left-hand box in the table on that page, the claim relates to a three-dimensional display system that could include the display of genetic information. And if you look at the amended claim, and that's all the way over in the right-hand box, the claim relates
to... Did you say
5999.
Okay, oh, thank you. I have been going off. I'm like, I don't think I have that page. 5999. I don't have that page. My appendix goes from
23.
From 2386 to 6888.
Your Honor, I believe it's in the confidential appendix. If we did not provide that particular page to the court, I'd be happy.
Oh, okay. Wait, I think I found it now. Where did you say?
9599.
9599?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I think that's that.
Your Honor, that page may have been dropped out because, frankly, the substance of the claims at issue here is not an issue that was before the court.
Okay,
and so it's something that the parties did not engage in their briefing. We do dispute the PTO's claim that the amendment here was anything like a shift, but it's not an issue that we raised into court, and it's not an issue that's been litigated by the parties. But as I was saying, the initial claim...
You're telling me what's before me isn't whether a restriction requirement would have been proper in this case, but whether there is a bar to restriction requirements like this altogether.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
In other words, PTO...
I think it was proper, by the way. If they're allowed to have one, it sure looks proper to me.
But Your Honor, all I would say is, if you look at that particular claim 146, and we're happy to submit a supplemental filing with that portion of the appendix.
I'm not going to reach whether a restriction requirement was proper.
I will say that it narrowed and focused the claims to deal with a three-dimensional display system focusing on genetic information. It was narrower. But in any instance, the question that's before the court is PTO's legal authority to enter the restriction requirement. And I'd like to begin with the statute. The URAA's text requires PTO to examine more than one invention in a transitional application. And Congress fleshed out the URAA by giving legal force to a statement of administrative action issued by the executive branch. The statement provides that the PTO is prohibited from restricting claims out of transitional applications. And there are only two exceptions. One is for restriction requirements made more than 2 months before the patent term changeover, and that obviously doesn't apply to a restriction that was entered in 2016. The other exception allows restriction when PTO hasn't entered a single office action in the application due to actions by the applicant. PTO has never contended that the applicant here did anything that prevented it from entering an office action in this application. And in fact, there were many.
So let me ask you, so when we deal with the regulation, you're not challenging the regulation, you're just saying it was misinterpreted and misapplied by the PTO.
Your Honor, we raised two arguments regarding the invalidity of the actions here. One is with respect, one is invalidity under the statute, the URAA, as fleshed out by the Statement of Administrative Action, and the second concerns PTO's noncompliance with its own rule. Rule 129. What I'm addressing now is the statutory argument. And we pointed out this basis for reversal in our opening brief. We made clear that the PTO did not satisfy either of the exceptions to the blanket prohibition on restriction requirements in transitional applications, and the PTO has provided no argument to the contrary whatsoever. The agency literally does not have an argument that explains how its actions that are under review in this case comply with the statute. And that is a very unusual circumstance. And I think the reason for that is there simply is no argument for the agency to make. The first exception doesn't apply on a temporal basis. And
so
the second,
are you saying that the regulation is... I'm just trying to understand the argument in its totality. Are you saying that the regulation is invalid because it's inconsistent with the statute? Or are you saying the regulation is appropriate and reflects it?
Your Honor, what we're saying is that the PTO's actions under review, particularly the restriction requirement, as well as its petition decision, violate the statute. That is this argument. And they are contrary to law for that reason.
When you say their actions under review, we got to back up. You're not answering her question directly. There are facial challenges, and then there are as-applied challenges. And those are two different things. And I think what Judge Prost is getting at is, which one of those are you making?
This is not, Your Honor, a challenge.
Is that what you're doing?
Okay. This is not a challenge to the regulation. If, for example, a PTO promulgates a regulation, a party
so
can, of course.
What if we determine that PTO complied with its regulations here?
I'm sorry.
What if we determine that PTO complied with its regulations here, interpreting this statute?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, I don't think that the PTO has, I don't think the court need reach that issue for two reasons.
I really don't understand what you're arguing at all. There's a statute, the PTO has implemented the statute in regulations, and so we look at whether PTO has complied with its regulations implementing that statute. If you want to challenge those regulations as inconsistent with the statute, you have to do that. You can't just say ignore the regulations, only judge us under the statute. That's not the way administrative law works.
Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. An agency of court...
To conclude, we could write an opinion in your view that says these regulations were complied with A to Z, but they were still, but their actions were still unlawful under the statute. And we don't get into whether that suggests, right, that you're challenging the regulation, right, which you're not doing.
Your Honor, I think the court could simply hold that the actions at issue violate the statute. PTO has to follow the statutory authority that limits its ability, its authorization under law. And in this instance, the PTO didn't do that. It took actions that violate the statute. Every agency is a creature of statute and cannot exercise power inconsistent with the statutory authority that governs its actions.
That sounds an awful lot like an argument that the regulations are inconsistent with the statute.
Well, we do also make an argument, Your Honor, that the regulations have to be interpreted and applied in a way that is consistent with the statute. In this instance, they were not. I'm certainly happy to move on to the regulatory argument, but I would like to make clear that a violation of the statute is...
In your brief, did you say the regulations are inconsistent with the statute?
I believe it's both in a topic heading, and we had an entire, subsection on that in our opening brief.
Tell me where.
I believe the topic heading says something along the lines of that the actions are inconsistent with the URAA, which is the statute. That argument was pressed in our
Would
brief.
Would you like to show me that? Because I don't see it in the table of contents.
I mean, you do have a heading that says the rule and the URAA prohibit restrictions requirements. So you seem to pair those.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to provide the specific reference on rebuttal, but I assure you it is in our opening brief, and we actually laid out an entire argument regarding PTO's obligations under the statute, and the PTO tendered no response to that whatsoever, and this wasn't the first time.
That doesn't sound like an argument that the regulations are inconsistent with the statute.
It's an action... There is a difference, Your Honor. But PTO's actions in this case must comply with the statute. The agency doesn't have any authority to act contrary to the statute.
Well, the headings are Rule 129 and the URA prohibit the restriction requirement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Comparing those two. And the second one just says the restriction requirement does not satisfy the regulatory exceptions.
Right, Your Honor. So that first argument that you highlighted, I believe it's subsection B of that argument, lays out why the restriction requirement in this case violates the URAA. And indeed, the topic heading says that the restriction requirement violates the URAA. I mean, that was in the topic heading. I don't think there was any mystery about what we were arguing here, and the court can certainly look at the arguments that were presented and see that we presented a statutory argument. As I said, I'm happy to address that on rebuttal, but I'm also happy to move on to the application of Rule 129. And just like the statute, Rule 129 generally prohibits restriction requirements, and the exception that was cited by PTO in this case covers circumstances where the examiner did not make a restriction prior to April 8, 1995 due to actions by the applicant. And PTO claims that that exception applies whenever an applicant adds claims directed to a previously unclaimed invention, because that means the applicant withheld or failed to file those claims back in 1995 and thereby prevented the examiner from making the restriction requirement. But the phrase actions by the applicant unambiguously refers to affirmative actions made through a written filing with the agency, and it doesn't reach inaction like failing to present particular claims at a particular time. PTO rules require that all business with the agency be transacted in writing, and PTO regulations have always used the phrase action.
Why wouldn't actions by the applicant include what you filed claims on? What the PTO is saying is you chose to pursue claims directed to one particular invention. You chose not to pursue claims directed to the other invention. So you made an action. Your action was in choosing which invention to pursue claims on. That is an action by you. You chose not to file them on anything else. You chose to file them on this. So why can't they then come back and enter a restriction requirement later? By choosing to file them on only one invention, you definitely prohibited them from filing a restriction requirement. You didn't include a second invention. They couldn't have filed it then. I don't know why that isn't an action by the applicant.
So I think there are two reasons, Your Honor. The first one is that if you look at PTO's regulations across the board, you will see that the term actions by the applicant or action by the applicant is used consistently to mean some type of affirmative action taken by the applicant.
But pursuant this wasn't to affirmative action. The affirmative action was your choice to limit your filing to only claims directed to the first invention.
Well, but when the PTO seeks to address that sort of omission or failure to file something, its regulations consistently use the word omission or failure to, or failure. They do not use words like action of the applicant, which refers to some type of express action that has a particular effect. And in this instance, you would expect the agency to use a word like omit or failure to make clear that it was rescinding a large part of the relief provided in subsection A of the rule through this sort of cryptic reference in subsection B. I don't think that's how anybody reading the rule would understand it to operate.
So but, actively withholding claims is inaction rather than action? Is that, I mean, you're saying that we should tease out the difference between action.
I think there is a difference, Your Honor, but I also think that there was no evidence and there was certainly no finding by the agency that Mr. Hyatt actively withheld the claims at the time as opposed to simply failed to file them by the time of the patent term changeover. But the second reason, and after that I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, is simply that PTO's interpretation of this instance violates the statute.
So you think his choice not to file claims to this second invention that's not an action on his part?
I don't think it's an action within. I don't think it's an action by the applicant within the meaning of the regulation, and certainly not within the meaning of the statute.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it Saltwort? Mr. Saltwort, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Peter Saltwort on behalf of the director of the USPTO. Congress passed the Uruguay Rounds Agreements Act to implement changes to patent term related to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. In the URAA, Congress gave the director rulemaking authority to accomplish the purposes of the rules. Did so in broad terms, left the details to the director.
Have you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but on the point you were making with your friend about whether or not he preserved a particular argument, and I mean, there is a page arguing about the URAA and why it's been violated. Did you address that issue specifically in your brief?
We did not, Your Honor. We don't see the brief as clearly raising a facial challenge to the rule, or nor one having been raised below. But in essence, it's even if it had been raised, the government views it as a non-issue because, contrary to my colleague's assertion, the statement of administrative action specifically states that one of the exceptions to entering a restriction requirement is if there's not been an action due to actions by the applicant. And those are the exact same words that are repeated, echoed in Rule 129 that we're here arguing about. So it's hard to see any possible or reasonable argument that a regulation that uses the exact same words as a statement of administrative action could somehow be inconsistent with it.
And is it your view that we start with the regulation and if we think that arguably, hypothetically, the action here by the office was consistent with the regulation, then in order to then go to the second, reach the second issue, which is, but it's arguably not consistent with the statute, he would have had to challenge the regulation?
Yes.
Or would we necessarily just go to that issue no matter what?
I do think it's incumbent to raise all the arguments before the district court to have the district court to have that opportunity, and there's not a clear facial challenge to the regulation being consistent with the enabling statute here. And again,
I think his argument, in fairness, is that to the way the PTO is applying the regulation in this case, to what he calls omission or inaction, is not consistent with the regulation because the regulation has to be consistent with the statute, and that would be inconsistent, right? He's saying we have to interpret the regulation in a way that renders it consistent with the statute, and he's saying there's a way to do that, and it's by requiring affirmative actions and not allowing omissions to qualify. Is that a fair? Do you understand that to be a fair characterization of his argument?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. But in that case, then I think that those issues collapse into one because of the point that I raised, that the regulation and the statute both have used the exact same words about actions by the applicant. So the words are precisely the same. So however they are interpreted, it has to be the same in both places, and it just becomes one issue to resolve.
It's not really a question of interpretation of whether the regulation complies with the statute. Is just an interpretation of the term action and what that means.
That's correct, because you would interpret the same in both places. It's the same word used the same way.
Okay.
So why the argument he made about active and passive and withholding and so, I mean, your brief does say actively withhold. Where do we get that? And is that in fact inconsistent with other regulations and so forth that differentiate between action and inaction?
I have two responses to Your Honor's question. As the Chief Judge already suggested, there was an action here. Mr. Hyatt submitted his application. He acted to submit an application, and he acted to choose which claims to include in that application. And if he believed he had written description support for multiple independent and distinct inventions, it was incumbent upon him to submit his application with claims to all of the inventions that he believed he described. So that was the affirmative action. He submitted an application with claims of his choosing and chose not to include claims to material that he apparently...
So this would cover no amendments. It would foreclose all amendments. It would allow restriction requirements in instances of all of subsequent amendments.
No, Your Honor, because there are many, many amendments that are possible that don't...
Only amendments that are directed to entirely new inventions, right? Like it wouldn't affect amendments if it's still directed to the same invention.
That's correct. The terminology that USPTO regulations use is independent and distinct subject matter. So it is possible to modify limitations, clarify language, write related claims. Those are the types of things that are contemplated under 129A. But if you entirely shift the subject matter of the claims or add claims to entirely new and distinct subject matter, then it becomes appropriate to look to 129B, which applies to restriction practice and it tells you when and when a restriction requirement cannot be entered.
So I don't want to make this case any more complicated than it already is, but your friend started with pointing us to a portion of the exhibit, I guess making the argument, I think, we didn't develop it, that they weren't distinct. They weren't substantially distinct. Was that issue adjudicated below? It's not before us, I don't think.
It was not adjudicated below. Mr. Hyde has never challenged in this APA case the appropriateness of the restriction requirement itself, that the determination that there were independent and distinct inventions being claimed.
So he's only challenged or adjudicated.
He's only challenging whether it was even possible for the USPTO to enter a restriction requirement here because of the effects of Rule 129. again, I think Judge Hilton did an excellent job below writing a clear and simple to understand decision about why this rule is clear. He described the rule as unambiguous, and USPTO agrees that there's no ambiguity in this rule. And I think in particular, just beyond the language of subsection B1.2 that we're arguing about, this language due to actions by the applicant, when you look at 129 as a whole, or at least 129B, you see that the bounce being struck, the intent behind it is that was the USPTO in the possession of the information it needed to enter a restriction requirement prior to the cutoff date? If the USPTO is lagging behind in processing applications and we didn't look at it in time and there were distinct inventions there and we didn't enter the restriction requirements so that a timely divisional could be filed before the change in patent term.
That wouldn't be due to the applicant.
That's not due to the applicant, that's right. The PTO's fault. But
what are
if
the
you
kinds
would...
of actions an applicant could take? Apart from not filing these claims to a separate invention, what are the kinds of things that could be due to the applicant that would fall under too little I? Can you give me some examples?
There are other examples that are pointed out in the MPEP, section 803.03. Examples there include applicant abandoned the application and continued to refile the application such that no office action could be issued in the application. The second example is applicant requested suspension of prosecution under 37 CFR 1.103A such that no office action could be issued in the application. The third example is exactly the situation that we have here. Applicant disclosed a plurality of independent and distinct inventions in the present or parent application but delayed presenting claims to more than one of the disclosed independent and distinct inventions in the present or parent application such that no restriction requirement could be made prior to April 8, 1995.
Is it your view that we need to give our deference to that PTO manual?
So I don't think it's necessary to reach that question. As we argued in our brief, we think that the regulation is clear and unambiguous, so we don't have to reach the question of deference. But if this court looks at all of the interpretational tools that the Supreme Court said in Kaiser have to be applied, in order to grant our deference and still finds it's ambiguous, then I think that it's hard to find a clearer statement than is reflected in the MPEP.
You didn't argue. I mean, I think you affirmatively said in your brief, we're not arguing our here. And so the other side didn't, I don't think they responded. I do think you said this is not. So, I mean, I guess I'm a little apprehensive about going down that rabbit hole.
We did, Your Honor, on page 34 to 35 of the red brief.
So I'm wrong?
The argument is similar there. It's brief, but it's similar to what I've just stated here, that we believe the regulation is clear and ambiguous, so it's not necessary to reach that.
Unambiguous. Okay. Oh, what you said is
sorry,
just
unambiguous. Sorry if I misspoke.
The district court didn't go down that route.
It did not. I mean, it did cite more Morgan Roth, which says that the PTO should get deference on some of these complicated regulations about abandonment, but the court twice stated that it found the regulation unambiguous and that the PTO is entitled to enter a restriction requirement here.
Okay, anything else?
If the court has no further questions, I yield my time. Thank you.
Mr. Grossman, you have some rebuttal time?
Thank you, Your Honor. And just a few short points. First, our statutory argument that the agency's actions violate the statute is in section 2C of our brief at pages 18 to 19, and it says that and argues that expressly. We also argued in section 3B that the agency's interpretation of the statute interpretation of the rule violates the statute. Second, as to the statement of administrative authority, I believe my friend slightly mischaracterized the exception that is at issue in the statement of provision. It states that the exception applies if there has not been at least one patent trademark office action due to actions by the applicant. It does not have the reference to restriction requirements that is contained in the rule. And that makes a big difference in two respects. One, it certainly supports our statutory argument given that there have been numerous office actions in this application prior to the entry of the restriction requirement. And second, it also affects the interpretation of the regulation because it's only affirmative actions by an applicant that can prevent the PTO from entering at least one office action. Those types of actions might include, as they were identified by the PTO in the final rule itself, repetitive refiling of an application and a request for suspension that prevents the PTO from acting. We think that's what the rule encompasses, and we think that's all the rule could possibly encompass so as to be consistent with the statute. A third point is that the PTO has offered no explanation at all how its interpretation of the rule is consistent with the statement of administrative authority. We briefed that issue. There was an entire section of our brief, a subsection of our brief, laying that out. The PTO has no response, and I don't think my friend has any response other than to simply incorrectly describe what it is that the statement of administrative action says, claiming that it refers to restrictions when it does not refer to restrictions. My friend also stated...
You're saying it doesn't refer to restrictions?
It does not, Your Honor. It bars PTO from entering restriction requirements, but then the exception that my friend referenced does not refer to restrictions. It refers to the PTO entering at least one office action, not a restriction, any office action at all. That's in the SAA. It's in the addendum to our brief.
Wait, where is this?
This is in the statement of administrative action. It's addendum 4.
At page 1005 through 1006, I thought it says it goes through the restriction requirement and then it says this limitation does not apply, blah, 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 blah.
So this is at the back of our brief, addendum number 4, page 5. And I will read verbatim from the SAA. This limitation, that is the limitation on being able to enter restriction requirements.
I'm sorry, you're just going to fail.
Addendum number 4, page 5.
Okay.
And it's at the very top of the page. So in the preceding page, the SAA lays out the blanket prohibition on restrictions. Then it says as follows. This limitation does not apply if such a requirement was first made in such application or a predecessor application more than 2 months prior to such effective date, not at issue here. And then the second exception, or if there has not been at least one patent and trademark office action due to actions by the applicant. And that's the whole point of our statutory argument, which is there were numerous patent and trademark office actions in this application prior to entry of the restriction requirement. The PTO conceded that below. And so that's why the agency has no argument at all that its actions in this case, the making and maintaining of a restriction requirement and abandoning an application based on that, have any basis in the statute whatsoever. The statute does not give the agency the authority to do that. The court has no further questions. We would ask that the decision below be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. This case is taken under submission.